to welcome Professor Prithu Rukmani, who's joined us as a Shiv Dasani, one of our two Shiv Dasani fellows this term. She has a distinguished academic career and has taught religious studies and women's studies in India, South Africa and Canada, and indeed still teaches at Concordia University in Montreal. She's been given many awards and is perhaps most famous for her four-volume translation and edition of Vijnana Bhikshu's Yoga Vartika. And she's more recently done two volumes of Shankara's Yoga Sutra Bhashya Vivarana, which came out a couple of years ago, I think. And today she's going to speak about value ethics in the early Upanishads, hermeneutical exercise, which is another one of her strong interests in hermeneutics. But before we begin, I thought we would just like to go around the table, as we're such a small group, and introduce ourselves. I'm Gavin Flood, and I'm the academic director here for the time being.
I'm Karen Rawls. I'm studying musicology.
Claire Robinson, I'm reading
theology.
I'm just a visitor.
I'm John Marie Schmidt, I'm doing a deep field in Shiva Vedanta. I'm Eric Moran, I'm doing a deep field in Himachali history in the 19th century.
In what, sorry, Eric?
Himachali history.
I'm Tithankar Bose, I teach Renaissance British literature. Hmm.
Monda Krantavos, I'm another Shiv Dasani
Joy Banerjee. I'm a retired person now and worked about 30 years for the County Council Education Department as an advisor and also senior lecturer. And now taking interest within the community, trying to involve people in Hindu studies. That's my interest. And she's the one who has inspired me to come into all these groups, into faith. Thanks to you.
And I'm Mary Osland, and I do a Master's in Religion and Politics.
I'm T.S. Rukmani. Okay, thank you very much. Should I begin?
Yes, just please.
Okay. I call this value ethics in the early Upanishads. As you know, the Upanishads are very many. There are about 200 Upanishads, to say the least. There's even one called Allo Upanishad. So, but then Shankaracharya commented or mentioned at least 13 Upanishads in his Brahma Sutra Bhashya. And out of that, he has commented on 10. And we normally, whenever we talk about the early Upanishads, these are the Upanishads we consider, which can be anywhere between 900 BCE to 400 BC. We consider them all pre-Buddhist in a certain sense, because the philosophical Buddhism has still not come into being before the 400 BCE. So in that sense, they are pre-Buddhist. Okay. Now, you might wonder why am I writing on ethics, because my interest in to write on ethics in the early Upanishads was kindled by my meeting a number of scholars of religion and philosophy who have misperceptions concerning the presence of any ethics in Hinduism. Very often, one hears the remark that there is no moral philosophy in Hinduism, almost suggesting that Hinduism has no ethical norms. This is a gross misunderstanding of Hinduism, to say the least. As scholars like P.T. Raju and others have pointed out, not developing a philosophy of ethics or not having a word equivalent to the Western notion of ethics in Hinduism cannot be equated to the absence of ethics in Hindu thought. I am reminded of Fichte, who told his countrymen that there existed in the German language no specific word for character, because to be German was automatically to be endowed with character. One could similarly say in a lighter vein that at the time that Hindu philosophy was in the making, the rules regulating life in society was well established, and there was no need for a specific word denoting the Western notion of ethics in Hinduism, as to be a Hindu was to follow the rules of dharma. Thus, Hindu thought or philosophy in its formative period took for granted that all humans are governed by the rules of the Varnashrama dharma. I'm not going to translate those, and by the Sadharana dharmas, common dharmas, when it applies, and could not therefore visualize anyone transgressing the codes of dharma. Thus, writers on philosophy take for granted a life lived according to the dictates of dharma and do not therefore expatiate on them. Ethics does not accordingly form a separate branch of Indian philosophy, as Raju says. So also, as Pandey remarks, there was an emphasis on the practical cultivation of moral principles as given in the social traditions, instead of too much discussion and ratiocination on moral philosophy. Unless one is sensitive to this way of viewing morality in the Hindu tradition, there can be no significant understanding of its ethical moorings. While this perception of a lack of moral philosophy in Hinduism is still prevalent amongst large sections of scholars and laypersons alike, one has to acknowledge the efforts of some Western scholars like Hopkins, McKenzie, Deutsch, including Flood, and others who have tried to demonstrate the sense of how the Hindus developed their own ethical views in the overall canopy of dharma. Another reason for looking for ethics in the early Upanishads is also because there is a widespread belief, even amongst Upanishadic scholars in the West, like Schweitzer, Zener et al., that one who is a liberated person while still alive, a Jivan Mukta, is beyond all morality and can indulge in any act, even immoral acts. I try answering this question somewhat later in the course of this paper. The tendency to expect all systems of thought to follow a Western paradigm has led to this misconception of scholars. We have to be sensitive to differing worldviews and not expect an ordering of values or concepts to fit only a Western paradigm. No society can survive without a sense of right and wrong, and there is no moral neutrality in any society. Eastern philosophy in general, and in this case Hindu philosophy with which we are dealing, is not particularly concerned with the origin of moral philosophy, which in any case can have no answer. The vast literature on moral philosophy in the West, which has not reached any conclusive conclusion till date, goes to show that there is no one way to understand the origins of ethics. Whether one supports the transcendentalist or empiricist origins of ethics, it is not the origins that one should be worried about. It is how people in the lived world use their sense of what is right and wrong that makes for a better world. And in keeping with the practical wisdom of ancient Vedic sages, while there was a nod of assent to the natural law of Ruta, which in common with physical laws was also acknowledged as the foundation of moral law, the looseness of the definition of what constitutes Ruta allowed for its development in different directions in subsequent periods, keeping pace with the cultural development of its people. I had occasion to state earlier in one of my papers that though situated in the West and knowing fully well that our writings would be read and used at least by some Western religious and philosophical scholars, there is no need to argue or pretend that there is a uniform model by which one can approach problems of theology, philosophy, ethics, etc., in order to make them accessible to a Western audience. As these disciplines may not even denote and have the same meanings in diverse cultures, it would be truer to state that the attempt of scholars who try to understand comparative areas in different cultures, like moral philosophy, for instance, would be willing to transcend their own limitations of culture specificity and appreciate the growth of that branch of study in its own respective setting. If it is quite possible to find some resonances and similarities in the way philosophy, ethics, theology, etc., developed in cultures across the globe, as have been noticed in the areas of Greek and Indian philosophy, for instance. With the above caveats, now let us look at the Upanishads. In the development of any principle or idea in the course of history, the ingenuity of the wise, who in today's parlance can be called social scientists, play a role in the guidance of their people in the right path, aided by the philosophers or thinkers, and thus they are together in truth engaging in a hermeneutics of interpretation of ideas available to them and trying to fit them into a changed scene. Since societies are not static and exhibit continuous growth, it is the task of those leaders in society who are concerned to preserve what is best in the tradition to be able to come up with renewed strategies to preserve the values that they consider to be the best in the culture they represent. In that sense, there have been hermeneutes spanning the entire history of Indian culture, starting for heuristic purposes within the Vedic period. It is in the way that new interpretations were put on old ideas and practices, even while preserving what was its essence, that helped in bringing new ways of understanding them. The foundations of moral theory in Hindu thought would rather look at the situation in hand and devise means to cope with them. When that is also combined with the pursuit of a specific end value like dharma or moksha, moral behavior is viewed as one which is not against some divine rule or law, but that which will make the achievement of that end value within access of the individual. This way of viewing moral behavior can also be a result of the view that the moral injunctions are to be interpreted as guidelines rather than as commandments handed down from above, which one has to follow for fear of consequences. A more difficult question to answer in the context of morality in the Upanishads is whether it is possible to talk about morality at all in a society in which there is inequality, and all those living in a society do not have the same equal rights, as was the case in the time of the Upanishads when the Varnashrama Dharma was in place. While this is a relevant query, it is also a fact that most of the writings on morality and moral philosophy round the globe have taken place in the presence of inequalities in society. Starting with Aristotle, who was complacent of the presence of slaves in his time, we find a host of philosophers in England like Hobbes, Locke, Butler, Hume, Price, Smith and others, all authoring works on morality within a society which had slaves and which abolished it only by the Act of 1833. It is also good to remind ourselves that women were not considered equal to men and earned their right to vote as citizens in England only in the beginning of the 20th century. Similarly, women and children were considered the property of men for quite some time in Canada. It is also pertinent that a number of moral theories were being propounded by philosophers during the colonial times, when around the world, in the British and the other colonies, the colonized were treated worse than animals. One has only to recall the way Mahatma Gandhi was thrown out of a railway compartment at Pietermaritzburg in South Africa to realize the distance between theory and practice in society. The judgmental attitude of one's own religion being morally superior to other religions can also be counted in the same category. And of course, moral laws applying only to humans that allow cruel and non-compassionate behavior towards animals and other beings, which concerns environmental ethics, has also to be taken into account in this calculation. Thus, we can make out a case for the possibility of discussing ideal moral behavior even when the ground conditions in which the debate takes place need not be ideal, which justifies a discussion about morality in the early Upanishads. In order for individuals and societies to survive in the world and continue to lead decent lives in their respective societies, it goes without saying that there must be cultivated a sense of decent moral behavior. This is only possible if there are some basic rules of moral behavior that govern all individuals as qua individuals, or as part of society, or as part of the larger world. And it is axiomatic that there cannot be a set of principles that can be the norm for all peoples of the world, in spite of appeals to the contrary by some moral philosophers. One can only hope that people follow the laudable universal norm that different people from around the world tolerate and respect each other. There have been philosophers in the past, like Kant, for instance, who argued for a categorical imperative, or a Prabhakara in the Indian context, who similarly argued for a moral stance of dharma for dharma's sake alone. The closest to a common morality that Bernard Goethe talks about was also expressed in the Sadharana dharmas mentioned in the Manusmriti, the Mahabharata, etc., as something to be followed by all persons. Whatever the approach to morality, it goes without saying that there is a symbiotic relationship between moral philosophy and society, and that in turn also depends on the understanding each society has of itself in terms of what constitutes its high value, its highest value. There is also the larger question of the meaning of life, which is engaging the minds of scholars like Thaddeus Metz and others in recent times. A number of theories are propounded by naturalists, supernaturalists, and nihilists as to the meaning of life, and there is also a further discussion as to whether There are different types of meaningful lives, i.e. whether a qualitative analysis is necessary or not. Without getting into the different permutations and combinations of a meaningful life, I believe, for the purposes of this paper, that a meaningful life is that lived in accordance with certain moral values that the society in which an individual lives holds dear. A meaningful life, for instance, in the Hindu worldview, could be one that strives for moksha, which is a value that goes beyond just obtaining happiness and fulfilling obligations. Coming back to the connection between ethics and society, there are philosophers like Alasdair MacIntyre who have demonstrated this thesis of the mutual dependence of moral philosophy and sociology in many of their works. In Homeric Greece, for instance, a person, if he discharged his allotted social function in the manner in which society expected him to discharge the function, would be considered to be good. Here, there is a moral judgment being made of one being good purely based on the person's performance or the behavior expected of him. If we carry the analogy a little further, we could then say that one who is good, judged by his performance, becomes a role model and upheld as an example in society for others to emulate. Then good as a moral value is not because good has a transcendent value, but because it fulfills the functional expectancy of a character in society. MacIntyre illustrates this by the example of the Homeric nobleman, who is considered to be good because he is brave, skillful, and successful in war and peace. In a sense, then, moral reasoning is serviced to fulfill the expectancy of a society in terms of the value it believes in and in terms of the kind of individual and social behavior that will achieve that value, which in turn it considers to be of the highest moral value. If we apply the same criterion of functional performances determining moral virtues to early Vedic society, we find that the Ritvik, or the officiating priest at a sacrifice, who performs his yajnas in accordance with strict rules, is considered as a good person, and he is also the character model for others to emulate in order to be considered a good person. This is so because the Vedic society we are concerned with values yajna and the performance of yajna in the prescribed manner as of the highest value, not for its own sake, but for the realization of Ritha, which is the teleological principle of physical and moral order that Vedic society believed in. If life was led in this manner, in consonance with Ritha, it will lead to material and spiritual welfare, both in this life and after death. The Vedic concept of Ritha arises not by our rational powers, but it is apprehended in terms of moral and aesthetic values. It is revealed in the Vedic scriptural practices of prayer and sacrifice. One can compare this belief in Ritha with the transcendent character of the idea of the good of Plato, or the unmoved mover, unmoved perfection of Aristotle. While Vedic society approached the intuition of Ritha through a life lived in piety, the Greek philosophers serviced philosophy itself in this task of realizing the telos. Thus, Plato declared that the transcendent good is incapable of adequate expression in words and can be gained only by a sudden illumination in a soul prepared for it by an austerity of life and discipline of intellect. Thus, the Vedic society we are concerned with believed in a telos called Ritha and leading one's life in accord in order to be in tune with Ritha. Of course, I do not mean to draw an exact parallel between the Greek concept of telos and the Rigvedic Ritha in all its dimensions, but the intention is to indicate the broad agreements in terms of an essence but that both these cultures believed in. In a teleological worldview, we can expect a shift in what will be considered as moral behavior when a change occurs in the concept of what constitutes the telos. In the changed milieu, then, that moral behavior which achieves the changed value will replace the earlier judgment. Thus, in a general way, one cannot but agree with MacIntyre's analysis about moral concepts being embodied in and being partially constitutive of forms of social life. If what is said above is accepted, then in order to talk about ethics in the Upanishads, one will have to try and understand the Upanishadic society as it evolved from the time of the early Vedic society. Our evidences for this exploration can unfortunately only be the texts that are now available. Thus, here I will try and point out what governed the moral behavior of individuals, both as individuals and as members of Vedic society, as seen in the Rig Veda. Then, after a brief sojourn into the world of the Brahmanas and the Aranyakas, I will concentrate on the early Upanishads to try and understand behavior in terms of the twin values of dharma and moksha which had come to characterize Upanishadic society. It will not be a gross misjudgment to say that Hinduism, using the word in all its incarnations from the Vedic times to modern times, has always believed in a telos, an essence, which a life lived in accordance with certain moral principles can reveal. This picture of Hinduism through the ages has held good generally up to the present times. There may be minor cracks visible here and there, and one is particularly aware of it in the context of globalization and so on, which are impacting society in recent times. But even so, to this day, a substantial part of the Hindu population believes in a telos, even though the telos itself can be understood in very different ways by different sections of the people. In order to place our topic in context, we have to start with the early Vedic society, in which Ritha was considered the cosmic and physiological moral principle, which underlies both the physical order in nature as well as what governs the right behavior of individuals. The Devas were in control of this Ritha in both senses, and the implication was that man must please the Devas not only by offering sacrifices to them, but also by leading a morally pure life. The Devas are themselves viewed as having reached their state of immortality by the correct performance of yajnas. Ritha is thus the ideal principle of ordering, the paradigmatic principle of ultimate reality. Ritha is also called Satya and signified the ultimate moral principle that informs what a good life can mean. Do you want some questions in between? Okay, Ritha is also called Satya and signified the ultimate moral principle that informs what a good life can mean. But is there a way of discerning what this Ritha is, which is said to guide one's normal life, moral life? The answer is that through the correct performance of yajnas, the rishis could directly perceive or intuit this Ritha principle as unfolding through successive layers of reality. Thus, in this society, those who conform to the Ritha telos and perform the yajnas in a prescribed manner would be considered good and morally virtuous, whereas the others would be bad and vice. If we have to list some of the basic moral characteristics of good in this period vis-a-vis the individual, it would be Shraddha, or faith in the efficacy of what one does, obedience to the rules as well as to the rishi who performs the yajna, considered as one who knows, self-discipline, and tapaha, or self-restraint, so that one avoids temptation to the passions and trains oneself in the path of yajna. Tapaha, or self-restraint, is given an important place equal to Ritha and Satya, as it is of great instrumental value in leading to Ritha. In fact, Rigveda 10.190 indicates that Ritha and Satya are the result of tapaha, or self-restraint. As Ritha has been conceived of as both a natural and moral law, this entails that the individual behaves morally towards others inhabiting the world, because only a moral behavior can ensure the welfare of all, including himself. Thus, even though self-interest can be the springs of action in Vedic society, this linking of self-interest with the telos dictated the moral behavior of humans in Vedic society, both as individuals and as members of a society. Statements like, "He who eats alone is a sinner," "I'm not going to quote," and "Let us meet together, speak together," etc., all indicate the high store early Vedic society placed on a harmonious social life. Along with the value of leading a good life, both here and hereafter, Vedic society also valued the principle of freedom and of individual choice. Thus, an individual could choose to live in accordance with Ritha or not, and in a sense, freedom to choose is viewed as of value. It is this freedom that enables the Muni, described in Rigveda 10.136, to walk out of a rule-bound society. But it seems from the hymn that the Muni has chosen to discard yajna as the mode has only chosen to discard yajna as the mode for realizing ritha. He still seems to work within the telos, for it appears that he has exercised his freedom to choose another mode to reach the same value. Along with the freedom to choose must have developed the notion of rina, or indebtedness to choose rightly. Thus, while freedom to choose was an option, there was the duty or indebtedness to choose correctly in order that one might preserve the integrity of oneself and the cosmic order. So in early Vedic society, we find ritha, satya and tapaha informing the moral behavior of a person, because that is how he affirms his identity in a teleological sense. Tapaha will in turn continue to add new meanings and dictate moral behavior in the later historical periods. Of course, the undue emphasis of the means, i.e. yajna, to the end, i.e. ritha, led to a ritualistic excess in the next phase of Vedic culture, i.e. in the period of the Brahmanas. Yajna almost replaced ritha in this Brahmanic period, and moral life accordingly revolved around the yajna paradigm, emphasizing all the purificatory ceremonies, the fasts, the baths, time of yajna, etc., which took on added significance. Personal cleanliness and strict adherence and obedience to rules, as well as faith in the efficacy of yajna, were the qualities that took precedence in this period. Though ritha lost some of its importance as the telos, it was replaced by yajna, which took on the characteristic of ritha in both its physical and moral dimension. The theory of karma was also taking shape, which at this time only emphasized the correct performance of yajna. Individual moral behavior was thus defined in terms of yajna performance, even though the societal obligations developed further through the earlier rina idea. In this period, therefore, we find humans enjoined to fulfill their debts to the devas by correct performance of yajnas, to the rishis who initiated them into their culture by the study of the Vedas, and to the pitris or ancestors by continuing the race through marriage and begetting children, particularly sons. It is always difficult to pinpoint whether ideas precede interpretation or interpretation of already existent ideas precede new developments, but this can only be an interactive process of give and take. For whatever reason, when the action model or yajna became important, paramount in the Brahmana period, a whole new paradigm shift took place, with the ultimate value being the correct performance of yajna. As karma was primarily ritual karma or yajna at this time, anyone who followed the correct execution of karma would be a good person. An indebtedness to the sages or rishis who have helped in preserving the cultural and intellectual memory has now taken the shape of paying society's debt to the rishis. This concept of rina, debt is here rina, itself is a new interpretation of what one owes to society at large. The earlier ritha concept had only a stipulation to act in accordance to what it is to be a human being by following the physical and moral order of the universe. There was no guidance as to what those moral principles were, whereas here we have a spelling out of those moral values in terms of what one owes to one's culture and cultural memory. One is reminded of what Aristotle and those who think like him have to say about of what constitutes philosophical ethics. Drawing on the connection or identity between virtue and knowledge, Gadamer discerns a connection between ethos and logos, between the adults becoming socialized through education and training, and the logos of justification. This is a restatement of Aristotle's idea that virtue does not consist merely in knowledge, for the possibility of knowledge depends, to the contrary, on what a person is like, and the being of each one is formed beforehand through his or her education and the way of life. There is an important pointer here. Ethics cannot be divested from the ethos of the group to which it belongs. It is the imperatives of family and social order in respective societies that dictate how moral philosophy develops in each society. We can understand this in terms of Gadamer's phrase, quote, "Indeed, recognizing human conditionedness is quite compatible with the sublime unconditionality of the moral law," unquote. Thus, while there is a realm of the unconditioned, it does not and need not inhibit one from an understanding of the moral philosophical underpinnings of a particular society, which are based on its own ethos. The ethos of the ancient Hindu thus shapes the formulation of his ethical virtues in many ways, and we see this development in the Brahmana texts and in the Upanishads. One can see that the values in the Brahmana period towards which a moral life points to. I hope we all know around this table that the Brahmana here are texts and not the caste. One can see what the values in the Brahmana period towards which a moral life points to has an emphasis on the continuation of one's community and people. While the earlier qualities of faith, obedience and self-restraint continue to guide an individual's life, the three debts have expanded an individual's moral obligation towards his own immediate community and towards the continued preservation of its cultural heritage. So now, knowledge of the scriptures and knowledge seeking per se have acquired added significance for leading a good life. The freedom to choose is still there, and it is this characteristic moral feature that will enable the future flowering of many ideas in different forms later in the Upanishadic period. Though the Brahmana literature does present a stultified, rigid adherence to the performance of yajna with blind faith, one has to remember that we get this picture from the selective character of the literature we possess, which indicates more of the spirit of the age in which the selection was made than of the one in which the literature was produced. But one significant shift that had happened and pointed out earlier is the spelling out of the debts to be fulfilled by humans and thus recognizing the duty one owes to others beside oneself. The freedom to choose and to question, which is in itself a moral behavior, led to the gradual devaluation of yajna and substituted in its place the twin concepts of dharma and moksha by the time of the Upanishads. The shift must have taken place, amongst other things, by society coming in contact with other cultures and other unorthodox religious schools like Buddhism, Jainism, the Pancharatra or Bhagavata school, the Kapalikas, and so on. Some of this shift in thought can be seen in the Aranyaka literature, but it is in the early Upanishads that we come across many examples of the shifts that are taking place and where there are trends which indicate a clear break with the past on the one hand, and where, on the other hand, there are attempts to salvage the best in the old and reconcile it with the new values. The tradition of this period shows a remarkable resilience to reinterpret new Nastika ideas to conform to its own Astika view, and in the process almost revolutionize some of the earlier concepts. The early Upanishads can be assigned to the period, as I mentioned, 900 BCE to 400 BCE, and include the Upanishads that are referred to in the Brahma Sutra Bhashya of Shankaracharya. As such, there are some belonging to the pre-Buddha phase and others that come within the formulation of Buddhist philosophy. The evidence from the Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya Upanishads do show that renunciation or sannyasa as a mode of life that favors moksha has already found acceptance in the tradition. Moreover, Buddhism and Jainism's philosophy of ethics will also contribute in the shaping of ethical values in Hinduism itself. Before we attempt to read the Upanishads for evidence of ethical ideas, we must know that a number of new ideas and social structures have come into being at this stage in Hinduism as well. The telos has changed from ritha to dharma. Society is divided into varnas or social classes. Both dharma and moksha vie with each other as the highest values to be striven for. And a social structuring of society in terms of classes and stages of life, varnashrama dharma, has also come into being. One of great significance in the moral context was the theory of karma, which at this time had developed into its full-fledged form, transferring the result of good moral conduct in one life to be rewarded in future lives. The freedom to choose between what is good and not good now devolves on the individual himself. All these structures may not have assumed the rigidity they will acquire almost soon after when the Dharma Shastras were composed, but there is enough evidence to conclude that many of these concepts and institutions were in place at the time of the early Upanishads. By now, a change had also taken place in the understanding of the telos. It is no longer outside of oneself, like ritha or yajna, but what one actually, in essence, is. And thus, there was a call to leave home and hearth and live a life of mendicancy, meditating upon the highest self within in order to realize one's true identity. The highest moral behavior in this milieu was a non-egoistic ethic where renunciation of the family, wealth, and society was advocated. All duality morality was devalued. If one has to realize the ultimate truth, and only one who could get over the sense of duality could realize the telos. The Atman was a permanent entity, and the belief in the transmigration of the Atman in accordance with karma till it attains moksha in the moment of realizing its own self was in place. While there are passages in the Upanishads that can be read in a dualistic manner, even in such a reading, moksha for oneself was the highest value. It is then quite pertinent to ask whether in this view of the Upanishads, where an individualistic telos seeks to actualize itself, there can be any room for moral behavior. I shall come back to this question a little later. It is good to remember in this context that texts very often present an idealistic picture of society which need not necessarily correspond to reality. While moksha was the highest value in the Upanishads, by its very nature, it can only be aspired for by a small minority. One has to believe that the general population was more in tune with living within dharma, which is the telos guiding their lives. The ethos formed by training for a dharmic life and for a life desiring moksha did not vary much, for the one aspiring for moksha had to go through the stages of life of a student and householder generally before graduating into the ascetic's way of life. Thus, that is the sannyasa ashram. Thus, the training for moral behavior was uniform, except in rare cases where one became a sannyasin straight after the brahmacharya ashrama. But in all cases, it was mandatory to go through the brahmacharya ashrama, which ensured moral training in accordance with dharma. Therefore, when we examine the early Upanishads, we can declare that there was available guidance for moral behavior in both instances, i.e., for those who value dharma as of highest value, as well as for those who opt for moksha. I will therefore argue that there are principles for individual moral behavior as well as correct behavior towards society, both when the highest value that guides an individual is dharma or when it is moksha. It is now well known that most of the individual Upanishads are not homogeneous texts belonging to one chronological period. This fact has been very ably demonstrated by Belvakar and Ranade. It is thus reasonable to argue that there are earlier and later compositions in individual Upanishads which will impact on the ideas found in them. However, in this paper I treat each Upanishad as one unit and try to discover their moral undertones. Thus, if we view society at this period in history as seen in the Upanishads, it is still the twin ideals of dharma and moksha that hold sway. Shankaracharya mentions in his Upodghata introduction to the Bhagavad Gita that dharma is of both kinds, one leading to abhyudaya, that is welfare in the world, and the other leading to nishreyasa or liberation, moksha. The specific dharmas assigned to people based on the varna and ashrama classification takes care of the specified role of each individual within a varna as well as within society. The ashramas that are directly concerned with those following dharma as the highest value are those of the brahmacharya and grihastha. The vanaprastha can be clubbed with the sannyasin aiming at moksha as the highest value. So keeping that in view, we can first look at those sections of the Upanishads which clearly have a moral message for those within society, and then examine the moksha passages to evaluate their moral content. We noticed how in the Rigvedic period both Ruta, the end value, and Yajna, the means to it, were viewed as external. In the Upanishadic period, Dharma has replaced Ruta, and the way Dharma is defined is interesting. While Ruta could be intuitively realized, we noticed that the obligation to observe the threefold Rinas already mentioned had made it possible for an individual to acquire Dharma through fulfilling those Rinas. The Rinas, even while retaining the cosmic dimension of Ruta, emphasized through the right performance of Yajna the personal acquisition of Dharma. There is thus a subtle shift and a stress on individual betterment, but the other two debts to the sages and ancestors are voluntary acts, and the emphasis in those two debts is on the fulfillment of one's obligation to society and to the cultural memory. The stress on the different varnas fulfilling their dharma was also an obligation. Thus, dharma, though defined for the various classes, was more an internal obligation to do one's duty, and the appeal is more to one's inner sense of justice, whether it is called conscience or antakkarana. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, in a significant statement, points to this inner dimension of dharma in the following episode. Brahman, after creating all the four varnas, says the Upanishad, was still not happy and then fulfilled itself by projecting dharma. Further, the Upanishad identifies dharma with satya, thus affirming the moral virtue of truth embedded in dharma. This is mentioned specifically within the context of a kshatriya who represents the ruler and points to a higher principle or dharma by which the king rules, i.e. Raja Dharma. Shankaracharya tellingly comments that dharma rules even the ruler. It is thus something right, implanted internally, which guides human conduct to do the right thing. And in the very next passage, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad extends the notion of dharma to the fulfillment of one's obligations, not only to the three earlier mentioned debts, runners, but also to one's fellow beings and to all living beings, which is, as you know, called the Panchayatnyas. The Upanishad thus makes the point that one's behavior is to be correct, not only towards other fellow beings, but has to extend to animals, beasts, birds, and ants. Built into this is the ethics of compassion and sympathy for all that inhabits the world. By leading a life of dharma, we are told that one attains well-being, abhyudaya, in this world as well as after death. So behavior in accordance with dharma has an end value as well. The same Upanishad also illustrates through the parable of Prajapati's instruction to the three classes of his children, the devas, the manushyas, and the demons, that each of these classes must practice dhamma, that is self-restraint, dana, charity, and daya, compassion, respectively, as virtues. Shankara's explanation of who the devas, manushyas, and asuras are is very interesting. He thus says that those who are basically virtuous but are tempted by desire are the devas among men. Manushyas are the ones who are greedy, and asuras, the demons, are men who are subject to anger, which can lead them to cruel acts. In recognizing them to practice specific virtuous acts, the Upanishad exhibits a rare perception of human weaknesses and strengths and prescribes dhamma, dana, and daya as moral guidelines. When we read the other Upanishads, we find that there are introduced a number of new guidelines, even while retaining the old morality for leading a virtuous life. The Chandogya Upanishad extols the virtues of yatna, knowledge seeking by study of scriptures, adhyayanam it is called, dhanam, charity, and tapaha, self-restraint. There is direct mention of the brahmacharya ashrama and an implicit reference to the householder here, and they are promised a meritorious afterlife for leading a dharmic life. The Taittiriya Upanishad is perhaps unique in containing a number of guidelines for moral behavior. While reiterating the telos of Ritha, the Upanishad further emphasizes not only self-instruction or acquiring knowledge as a virtue, but also teaching others in the community as a virtue. Swadhyaya and Pravachana. Self-discipline and self-restraint in the form of control of the outer and inner organs are insisted upon. Of the five debts, the debt to humans is now spelt out as both hospitality and social good conduct. The refrain to learn and teach is added to every sentence in this section, thus informing us the value of educating future generations in the accepted mode of moral behavior. What is interesting in the Taittiriya Upanishad is that some of the passages address themselves purely to a worldly context without necessarily connecting them in an eschatological sense. Thus, the section 1.11.1-4 is addressing itself to a brahmachari who is about to go out into the world after his education and is like a modern convocation address. I give just a few from that section. Speak the truth, observe dharma, do not neglect the pursuit of knowledge. Satyam vada dharmanchara sounds so much better in Sanskrit. Treat your mother as a deva, treat your father as a deva, treat your teacher as a deva, treat guests as deva. Please follow this line, very important. Follow only those actions of ours that are praiseworthy and not others. This is what the teacher says. Charity should be given in with faith. Do not give without faith. Give plenty and give with humility, not arrogantly. If you are in doubt regarding an action or regarding behavior, follow those, they call it brahmanas, I translate it as wise ones, who are there, who are capable of deliberating cogently, who are dedicated to their duties and who follow the customs, who are not cruel and who are not devoted and who are devoted to dharma, i.e. Shankaracharya translates that as who are not victims of desire, akamataha. These are some of the instructions given to a brahmachari who is entering the world. And one can see that some more interpretations are being provided for the earlier five deaths. The duty to continue the race, respect for elders and the teacher, charity along with the right attitude of humility and not arrogance that should accompany any charitable act, the modesty on the part of the teacher to admit that even the teacher need not be followed blindly, but only his good deeds are to be emulated, and of course the advice to be guided by the wise men in society whenever one is in doubt are all virtues which are relevant for all times. The Taittiriya Upanishad is also a unique text to point out that it is not possible to measure human happiness. While the passage in question, i.e. 2.8.1-4, is intended to glorify the bliss of the knower of Brahman, the message it conveys is that there is no end to the concept of happiness as it is a relative concept. Another important Upanishad that has ethical prescriptions is the Kathopanishad, which has many similarities with the later Bhagavad Gita. This Upanishad raises the question of virtue and vice in terms of what happens after the death of a person and tries to argue for a life that is good, Shreyaha, contrasted with that which is merely pleasant, Prayaha. The two words, Shreyaha and Prayaha, are significant. Prayaha does not denote hedonistic pleasure, but as Shankaracharya hints in his commentary, Prayaha is the dharmic path chosen for the sake of Abhyudaya in this world and hereafter. It is how one directs one's emotions and feelings towards Shreyaha or Prayaha that determines who is seeking moksha and who is opting for dharma respectively. There is also an exhortation of the virtue of self-control in the Kathopanishad using the picture of a chariot drawn by horses compared to the senses. The reins are compared to the mind and the charioteer who wields the reins to the intellect. Thus the individual is cautioned not to give in to the inclinations of the senses without any self-restraint. The Mundaka Upanishad, like the Isha Upanishad, has sections extolling the path of dharma. The Mundaka Upanishad proclaims that truth alone triumphs and not untruth. Satyameva Jayate. And in a telling message declares that desire is the root of samsara. While earlier we noticed the Taittiriya Upanishad talking about the relativity of the feeling of happiness, the Mundaka Upanishad proclaims that only one without desires can hope to attain ultimate bliss. It occurs in the context of the description of a Jivan Mukta, but dealing from that ideal, it points to two things. One, that one desire leads to another and another without exhausting itself. And two, only when a state of no desire is reached will there be ultimate happiness. Almost like Kant, who enjoins us to seek not to be happy but to be deserving of happiness, the Mundaka Upanishad enjoins a state of desirelessness in order to deserve ultimate happiness. Thus it presents a state of ultimate bliss as being without desires. The Isha Upanishad goes a step further and anticipates the Bhagavad Gita when it says in its first verse that the world is enveloped by Isha and therefore one is asked to enjoy the world with a sense of detachment. This will eventually be spelt out later by the Bhagavad Gita in its theory of Nishkama Karma, which is a hermeneutic exercise of the first order. However, that is beyond the scope of this paper. Six students, Sukeshan, Satyakama, Gargya, Kaushalya, Bhargava and Kabandhi, approach Pippalada and seek ultimate knowledge from Pippalada in the Prashnopanishad. Pippalada asks them to lead a virtuous life for a whole year, practicing self-discipline, self-restraint and faith so that they become fit for higher knowledge. Thus the Prashnopanishad does not let us forget the basic moral qualities of faith, self-discipline and self-restraint. The Maitrayani Upanishad, the Shvetashvata and the Mandukya are later ones, and they are much later than what we have discussed above. The Maitreya Upanishad, amongst them, is important for its section on yoga, where sense control is extolled as a virtue and the pure mind is described as that which is freed from desire. While Shankara the Advaitin propounded a philosophy of non-duality based on the Upanishads and also declared that knowledge alone will achieve moksha, discarding a combination of action with knowledge, the Upanishads, when read by themselves, lay down rules of conduct for those who pursue dharma as well as for those who desire moksha. And it is in the manner in which one becomes fit for dharma that we saw a number of guidelines laid down for moral behavior. It is now necessary to briefly examine, I'll be brief now, I think. I hope you still have, you're concentrated, you're not bored. Okay. It is now necessary to briefly examine how the value of moksha brought in some changes in the emphasis of certain moral values. Even when the Upanishads declare that vidya or knowledge which informs dharmic behavior is an inferior kind of vidya, aparavidya, as opposed to that which teaches higher knowledge, paravidya, leading to moksha, that is more in the rhetoric than in the actual fact. The moral training was similar for both the goals of dharma and moksha, which were spelt out as charity, self-control, truth, tapaha, etc. Commenting on Ishopanishad 15, where the aspirant is praying to the sun, Pushan, to reveal the truth hidden behind it to one devoted to truth, Satya Dharmaya, Shankara glosses the word Satya Dharmaya as one who is Satya Dharma because of meditating on truth, and alternately as one who has rightfully performed dharma. This is very important. Thus, the truth by implication is revealed to both the follower of the higher path of meditation or the performer of dharma. As the stage of renunciation, sannyasa ashrama, was in general the last of the ashramas after going through brahmacharya and grihastha, the ethos or the moral laws imbibed during the initial staying in those stages were part and parcel of the ethical virtues which both dharma and moksha aspirants had in common. The powerful example of Yajnavalkya in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad stands before us as the ideal. He is a person who gradually progresses through the different stages of life. Even if some special person opted for sannyasa without going through the grihastha stage, he still had to go through brahmacharya, and thus no one was exempt from the first stage wherein were already laid the foundations of a moral behavior. Some special rules of behavior which got added emphasis in the context of moksha and in the context of the theory of karma were the selfless performance of action and inculcation of the sense of equality in the wake of the identity between the Atman and Brahman, and a devaluation of the sense of ego, Ahankara, or the sense of ego that alienates one from all other living beings, is roundly condemned, and the truth of unity is repeatedly emphasized. It is the tyranny of egoism that prevents one to have a genuine feeling of love for all, and therefore the cultivation of a sense of identity with other beings that constitute the world became a moral value. Similarly, self-restraint was raised to a high status in this climate, though it was not unimportant in the Yajna Dharma milieu as well. After all, there were many rules to be observed for the correct performance of yajnas, and therefore there would have to be practice of restraint on one's natural inclinations. So the twin virtues of non-egoism and self-restraint or self-denial attain paramount importance as moral virtues in the context of moksha. However, the total exhaustive nature of self-denial that was required of an aspirant for moksha is noteworthy. By linking the last purushartha, that is moksha, with the last stage of sannyasa, sannyasa ashram, self-denial or renunciation was total in every sense of the term as far as the individual was concerned. One had to abdicate, you know, putraishna, lokaishna and vittaishna. One had to abdicate attachment to one's family, to society and to wealth in any form. These are the desires that are most difficult to overcome and are set before a mumukshu, one desiring moksha, as the path to the ultimate value. Such exalted standards of moral behavior was in keeping with the highest value that the Upanishadic society visualized for itself. Whether such a vision can coexist with moral behavior in the world of daily existence seems to the Indian mind a redundant question. However, there have been thinkers in the West who have questioned the very presence of morality in such a worldview. I come back now to the question raised earlier as to whether there can be any moral behavior in an individualistic telos seeking to actualize itself. In this context, I am reminded of Professor Zener's concern of the blurring of the boundaries between good and evil in Upanishadic philosophy, which emphasizes only the reality of the one Brahman and its identity with Atman. Zener follows in the tradition of Western philosophers in general, starting with Hegel, for whom only a metaphysics based on duality makes sense. As this is a serious question, I think it is my moral duty to try and answer it, and in the process try to explain how there can be a moral philosophy in the Upanishads, even though it believes in a unitive vision. It is good to remind ourselves that the sannyasin in the traditional accepted sense has gradually come to adopt the last stage stage of sannyasa. And thus is one who has already imbibed the moral virtues of the culture in the previous ashramas. Except in exceptional cases, as pointed out earlier in the paper, and maybe a person like Shankaracharya, he is the one who has lived a moral life in accordance with the rules of brahmacharya and grihastha. Even in the exceptional cases when one adopts the last ashrama, like Shankara, the person would have gone through brahmacharya, wherein are laid the foundations of moral life. Thus the sannyasin, having gone through that stage, knows what is morally good and what is not. Therefore, there is no blurring of boundaries, as Zeno would have us believe. The late B.K. Mathilal has also dealt with this question in his The Logical Illumination of Indian Mysticism, and in what follows, I am summarizing his views. It has always been emphasized, as Mathilal says, that one cannot gain liberating knowledge without having lived a perfectly moral life. What this means in a rhetorical manner is that, quote, when one realizes the ultimate reality, cosmic consciousness, the good-evil distinction sloughs off as an inessential and unnecessary detail, for evil has been overcome, and without evil, good loses its original meaning, unquote. Mathilal distinguishes between the ordinary distinction between good and evil in the world and the symbiotic relation that exists between good and evil in ordinary life, which exist intimately related to each other like light and darkness, thus they stand together or fall together. This good he calls as good one, and when evil is eliminated, good one is also destroyed. At that stage, called variously as moksha, nirvana, etc., good too makes its presence felt, which is the ultimate good. He uses many more examples to illustrate this truth. In substance, he emphasizes that our worldly behavior only operates within the realm of good one, and also points out that in order to reach good two, one has to go through good one. At the level of good two, the previous duality of good and evil no longer prevails, and there is only oneness of reality. One can therefore argue that the dualism of good and evil ceases to be operative in good two. This is precisely what the Upanishads point to when they say, quote, I'm translating, what delusion and sorrow can there be for one who sees oneness? Komoga kashoka ekatvam pasyatah. The same idea is expressed somewhat differently by Billington. He thus says that the state of liberation is not that it leads to disregard of benevolence to other sentient beings, but that benevolent acts and any others that may be termed morally desirable are viewed as an intuitive expression of the experience of oneness with all beings, rather than as a painstaking observance of rules for which rational arguments may be offered. This is a deeper level of experience than the dualistic state, which is the context of moral decision making. This brief sojourn above into the world of the early Upanishads has revealed how there was a close connection established between moral behavior and the realization of the essence of what it is to be a human being. This connection was made possible because of the nature of the Bandhuta theory that developed and reached its full growth by the time of the Brahmana text and was the legacy of the Upanishads as well. This was an interpretive device perfected by the late Vedic period. Bandhuta is the belief in the presence of some subtle secret and mystic bond connecting a thing and its bandhus, and the bandhus amongst themselves. This is Ranade's quote. The unitive principle of Ritha had already initiated the beginnings of the conviction that the structural constitution of the human being discloses the very structure of the world. Therefore, the belief in a telos like Ritha, Dharma, or Atman, Brahman made it possible to regulate one's moral life in such a way as to realize the telos which one in essence is. I have tried to present the ethical virtues as gleaned from some of the early Upanishads and to situate moral behavior within a telos and within an ethos. I have also pointed to the many ways in which the Rigvedic sages try to bring the Ritha, Dharma, Moksha telos within the range of human understanding. The Upanishads try to make sense of Dharma in many ways. We already saw how the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad relates it to the dictates of conscience for right action. In other places like the Taittiriya Upanishad, in the instruction to the brahmachari, we got the sense that when the student follows those instructions, he was acting in a dharmic manner. The Chandogya Upanishad credits one with vijnana, discriminate discernment, to be able to intuit what is dharma, adharma, truth, falsehood, what is good and what is bad, etc. Thus, there is a serious attempt in these early Upanishads to find a basis for right moral conduct. In the search for the source of moral conduct, philosophers and religious thinkers in all cultures are baffled as to the origins of the concept of good and good moral behavior. questions like whether morality depends on the right and able exercise of man's rational powers, which can enable him to choose between virtuous and non-virtuous actions, or whether it is possible to conceive of a normative moral standard by the exercise of man's rational powers for all times, similar to the norms of mathematical rules, will continue to plague humanity as long as it lives. In areas like this, where human reason failed to provide a satisfactory answer, there has developed a belief in a telos in some cultures, which informs what the correct behavior ought to be in order to be in tune with that. There have been different theories put forward for this dependence on a telos for moral behavior by many philosophers. I conclude this paper with one such theory by G.C. Pandey. Quote, conceptually, ritha may be assimilated to natural law, at once cosmic, moral, and ritualistic. It must be remembered that the distinction effected by modern thought between being and being right, and of both from being in accordance with right, R-I-T-E, or law, did not obtain in that earlier society. The modern distinction, in fact, arises from the distinction between knowledge and will, the latter being free to follow any fiat within the bounds of desire and impulse, which are regarded as non-rational. On this view, the will becomes arbitrary or non-rationally determined, and thus the principles which it follows cease to have any reason or connection with reason, just as the latter remains concerned only with the nature of things and contains no directive principle for the will. The ancient period, including the period of the early Upanishads, had a richer conception of reason, which made it reveal facts as well as values, natural as well as moral laws, unquote. Perhaps one can conclude with the thought that a teleological worldview of the self can most likely help in the avoidance of extreme forms of individualism that has, for instance, corrupted the moral structures of many societies since the 18th and 19th centuries. Thank you very much. You've been very attentive.
Well, thank you so much for a very interesting paper and a historical sweep there that you've given. If I can start, perhaps, well, there's two questions I have. One is that you describe rita, and you've linked that in with the performance of ritual, and you've described the shift from in the Upanishads towards dharma, if you like. So my question is ethics always linked to the performance of ritual in the first instance? It's very interesting, this. You have a good person is the person who performs the correct ritual, and then later you get a complete shift, so that a good person is not the person who performs the correct ritual, but a person with certain kinds of inner qualities, and that's a very interesting shift. And the latter we would call ethics, and the former we wouldn't call ethics, probably. Yeah.
But
shall
I answer that first?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Because I'm trying to look at other societies as well, because that's why I brought in Greece Greek society as well, where a nobleman is considered to be good. He can go back home and beat his wife.
Yes.
Well, you see,
yes.
It doesn't matter.
Yes.
But as far as he is conforming to the principles that the society believes in,
yes,
he has to be brave, he has to go and fight well, and so he's a good person.
Yes.
And everybody emulates him.
Yes.
So also in Rigvedic society, the person, the Ritvik, the person who knows the rituals, how to correctly perform it, he's the good person. Is so that, yes, that's very clear in the... But as I said, we do not have all the Vedic literature available to us. We only have, as in Purva Mimamsa, they very rightly say that not all Vedas are still available. Most of them were lost, so we don't know what was there. But from available texts, this is the idea that we get. Because even the Devas intuited ritha by the correct performance of yajna. It says so. Okay. Now, when you come to the Upanishads, it's not as if they completely marginalize ritual. I think I've made that clear. But they now, other values have been added on. Because ritha, as I pointed out, was more a transcendent principle. It was external to oneself. But now the shift, there's a big paradigm shift where you find dharma can be acquired by one individual performing certain acts. Now this was a very big shift. And it is there that, yes, dharma, you, by fulfilling your debts to society, you can acquire punya. That is dharma, dharma punya. And by not doing that, you are acquiring papa.
Right.
You see, that kind of issue. But rituals again follow. It is not as if they are completely marginalized. You can still, because the Grihya Sutras are still there. The Shauka Sutras are still there. So by the Upanishads, you know, these are all horizontal. I wouldn't even put them chronological as we normally. These are horizontal phenomena. And these are all happening side by side. So it's not as if they're completely marginalized. Yes, the emphasis definitely had changed.
And it's also, presumably, to the internalization of the sacrifice of the Upanishads as well.
Definitely, definitely. Because that is where the Aranyaka started that. The Ashwamedha Yajna, the horse is supposed to be, you know, the mind, and the whole thing, the metaphor changes. You internalize the whole thing as sacrifices.
So karma, which is which is ritual action, originally, then takes on an ethical quality.
Definitely. And that is why, because an ethical quality and then extends to a moral dimension of even determining what kind of a life you will have in the next birth based on what you do in this birth.
It's a very different idea.
And sort of connects. That's where the hermeneutics comes in, because each link, if you look at it, you find the links, the spokes. It's almost a connecting link here. And you can see that. And the Brihadaranyaka tries very hard to explain what dharma is and connects it with a conscience. So it's not just external performance. So all these dimensions are coming up.
I have something. Is there anyone? Talking about Rita, at one point you mentioned that devas control Rita. Do they? Or
Control. I said they also realize.
Rita. I must have heard it wrong.
Correct performance of ritual.
Because Rita should be beyond.
It's a transcendent ontological principle.
But later on, the idea of Rita is less felt or heard. In any
you
shastras.
Hardly hear it, except in the Yoga Sutra.
So when dharma took over, the idea of dharma took over. But Grihya Sutras and all those, they are not, as I said, parallel. They didn't develop during the Rig Vedic period, but later, when the performance, Ayurveda at that time, and during the also Upanishadic time, that's when the dharma was emphasized. And Rita just went away.
Went away, except as I said, some words come up, like in the Yoga Sutra, for instance, you have Ritam Bhara Tatra Prajna.
Okay.
See, when you practice Savichara Samadhi, then it is that stage when you really get into Sampratnyata Samadhi. And what is Sampratnyata Samadhi? Then they explain it. At that stage, you get Prajna, and it is called Ritam Bhara Prajna. And for Sanskritists who know the word, Ritam Vibhartiti Ritam Bhara. That which bears the truth is Ritam Bhara Prajna, that understanding, that insight which can reveal the true nature of the object you are meditating upon is known as Rita. So Rita did not really lose out. It retained its purity of meaning, but you're right, it went out of circulation.
Right, but when you look at the Mahabharata story, that's where Rita comes in.
Rita definitely comes in.
When he has to die that's when the Rita.
Right, it takes the moral.
The moral.
Because
moral,
what
the cosmic truth.
Yes, in fact, I wanted to go back to the topic you raised just before. And it seems to me you've presented kind of a chronological depiction of how things unfolded as the texts were created, written down, and it seems to me, perhaps it's a personal question, in fact, because you are especially the Advaita Vedanta, and I was wondering if you, because since Shankara presents a twofold dharma, twofold vision of dharma, and for him it cannot be presented again, and you pointed it out afterwards, it's kind of a horizontal way to look at things and not a vertical one. You present a vertical.
For heuristic purposes.
So I was wondering if you see there perhaps a discrepancy, and do you think that it was possible perhaps to actually, for Shankara to see, because I think he was aware of the fact that there were, of course, even in each individual Upanishad, different periods of time, in which they were written. I was wondering if you thought that he was able to correctly deal with these issues, or if you think it's an issue yourself.
You mean dharma versus moksha?
Yes. Do you think it was really kind of like a later addition, and therefore the values which the Ayana, the sacrificing to the self, which came later on, replacing the Yajna, the value on Yajna, was that really kind of a later appendage, or was it always there, really, but you know, kind of underpinning everything
no,
else?
Yeah,
I mean, what's your
No, I would say that you know that every Veda, you have to look at it horizontally, because you do not, and every Veda has its own Brahmana, its own Aranyaka, and its own Upanishad. So in a certain sense, the Rig Veda will have its own. These are horizontal texts, because they were put together. These are family texts, as we all know, right? These are all family texts, and they were all collected together at some point when it became necessary. That's why you will find that there is a order in which the mantras are even given. Like, you know, everyone will have Agni first, and then the lesser amount of mantras first. So there is a methodology there which has been followed. So in a sense, all this was collected together. Now, what happens is, when you look at it, for heuristic purposes, naturally, one has to talk about them as different texts. But are they chronologically in different periods? No. But as ideas, are they developments? That's why I use the word hermeneutics. You see, even in this room, for instance, we are doing hermeneutics. You are bringing in one kind of an interpretation. Gavin brings another kind. So we are talking about different ways of looking at it. So also this collection of Vedic literature, Vedic corpus you could call, which contains the Veda, the Brahmana, the Aranyaka, and the Upanishad as one corpus, has different ideas being presented, development of ideas from the Rigvedic Rita Telos to the Dharma Moksha, and you know, that is what I was trying to do. Does that make sense? Now, coming to Shankara, certainly it is historical. Because Shankaracharya, like what we are doing in the 21st century today, we are bringing in some subjective hermeneutic exercise, because after all, I mentioned Aristotle, I mentioned Billington, I mentioned Zeno. I wouldn't have been able to do all this if I had been doing only in a traditional matha, reading Advaita Vedanta. So in a certain sense, we all bring in time and place and context comes into our discourse. So Shankaracharya, belonging to the 8th century, having traveled all the way from the south to Banaras, coming in contact with others, he certainly brings in these, but his own interpretation as well. Have I answered your question? I don't think so.
No, maybe
you want to reword it.
My question very well.
You want to reword your question? I didn't probably get it.
Because he sees in the Katha Upanishad, for example, in two, as you mentioned, Shreyasa on the one hand, Prayasa.
Yes.
So these,
and he mentions it as positive, because
yes,
he is not
yes.
mentioning it as hedonistic pleasure.
Yes.
You see, there's a tendency, if you look at later translations, they would say, oh, living a pleasant life, that will not lead you anywhere. You have to always follow Shreya. No, that's not what Shankaracharya says. He says, it only means that you are leading a dharmic life. You will attain Abhyudaya, but my dear friend, you will not attain moksha, you will have to come back to the earth. That's all he says.
But what I read from his interpretation is that these various ethical behaviors, which correspond to these two tilos,
yes,
were
yes.
always there at all times. It's not like there was really a shift in the history, in the development.
Emphasis shifts, yes.
Just
it's only an emphasis.
Emphasis.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Definitely. That's why it's one corpus. Eh?
Mm.
Okay.
If I can ask, I'm not a specialist in all these ancient studies, but exactly this kind of shift, because when we talk about eventually primarily in the Vedic period, there's the sacrifices to the gods in order to maintain this world of ours, if I understand it correctly, and the gods are always actually free of moral or ethical constraints in a way. They're in the state of lila where they can act in a way that we wouldn't understand necessarily. Am I correct? Stop me if I'm wrong.
No, I think I'll stop you here. Because, now, I have problems the moment you say deva. I mean, gods,
yeah.
Okay? Because the devas, for instance, if we start with the Vedas, they are assigned, it's a kind of a looking at nature with wonder. And wherever there are human impossibilities, like you can't create rain or thunder, then we attribute that kind of a power to a divine essence, and that is called a deva, and that is why it is div, from shining, something which you cannot really understand. Okay, so now they, at this point, I don't know why you said they can do whatever they want.
No, that's, I didn't get to phrase that properly.
Okay.
What I'm thinking is perhaps these constraints on moral behavior for people actually, and the striving for moksha as a goal, kind of releases you from these from the world of devas in the end, right? Because it's the stage, if I understand it, more
devas are
better than
lower.
Being,
yes,
yeah.
No, because you are actualizing yourself. You are realizing who you are.
Whereas they are.
Oh, okay.
To take it to an extreme, slaves to their desires, in a sense.
Yes, I will put it this way. This is only one interpretation. Okay, the Upanishads are. It so happened by the time we reach the Upanishads, the emphasis on an outside reality has been diminished. You see, the search has, because in the Vedas, Brahmanas, you find the emphasis is towards the devas. We are trying to find out what this other reality, metaphysics is what is happening here, okay? It's a metaphysical search, and the metaphysical notion was that reality was outside of oneself. Now, slowly, the shift took place that you cannot look for reality outside of yourself. The search has to go within. Now, that is the basic difference. External reality versus you are what, in essence, the ultimate principle is you yourself. So, this is what the Upanishads are doing. Maybe right or maybe wrong. Now, when you say there is a whole lot of bhakti literature, a whole lot of duality which comes in later, for that, the Upanishads do have some help, but not too much. But the Upanishads have really emphasized on this Atman-Brahman identity. And so I think there you have to really look for moksha in a different kind of definition, which is knowing yourself. Knowing yourself, okay? And Shankara, of course, and these three or four, seven actually Vedanta Acharyas will interpret the Upanishads differently in keeping with their Vedanta philosophy. Achitya Veda, Veda would be one of them, actually. We can continue. Yeah, so...
Continue, because this can go on forever.
It can go. Because there are certain different ways of looking for moksha, you see. Even moksha can be defined in so many different ways. So in that sense, whether it's outside of yourself or whether it is you yourself, Atman Brahman identity is emphasized in the Upanishads to a large extent. But if you ask me the question, is there no reference whatever to duality, I would say, I can't say no. I said no, certainly there will be references to duality. But then the emphasis is on moksha, realizing yourself. Even in the, when they describe the duality, the emphasis is not realizing that outside yourself, but moksha for oneself. So in that sense, moksha is the ultimate value, as well as a kind of definition of one's own nature, realizing one's own nature. That is the importance of the Upanishads. That will get interpreted differently in the bhakti context. Ramanuja, Madhva, they will do it differently. Okay? Have I answered your question?
Has it started with Kasmai Devaya Havisha Videmo and from that kind of...
That is inquiry, I would say.
Yeah,
yes.
Inquiry. I mean, mm-hmm. Inquiry starts this whole thing, process,
yes, yes,
right?
Yes, that's so why I said freedom to inquire, choice. You know, these are very important values, so moral values, because you're not told, just believe it. Don't ask questions. No, that is never there in the Rig Veda. Of course, you know the two interpretations of Kasmai Deva.
Kasmai, yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, you also have... I know we can go on.
Well, we've got some hubbubs.
We have. Okay, so... because the Rig Veda is very fascinating in that sense. Not only Kasmai... You know, the unity, we normally think of the Upanishads as bringing in this idea of unity for the first time. Not so. Ekam sadvipra bahudha vadanti, everybody knows. Also, there are many more statements in the Rig Veda which emphasize this unitive principle. Also, the Brahmanas, we dismiss the Brahmanas because they have more of ritual, that kind of... you know, laying down what you should use, what the stick should be, where the sacrificial ladle should be kept, what kind of a thing you should put in the fire. But 40 generations, if you look at the, I won't say chronological, but if you look at the number of generations who have lived before the Brahmanas, that entire corpus, you will find 40 generations of rishis have contributed to the philosophical thought in the Brahmanas. So you find a lot of philosophical ideas in the Brahmanas, but somehow we never look at them properly because Maximula is the culprit there, because Maximula dismissed that whole thing as saying it's all mumble jumble, you see. One can't really dismiss that. He gave importance only to the Upanishads. But that is wrong, because we have to look at this whole literature. And I think there are some studies now, people are going back to the Brahmins. Most of them may not be useful, but some of them are. It's always like that, right?
What exactly does the statement, realizing yourself, mean?
You see, they believe that yatha brahmande tadha pinde. That means, like the micro is not different from the macro. In other words, the Rigveda already thinks that the structure of the individual is exactly the structure of the universe. And so if you are able to by... Now don't ask me, I have never realized moksha, but I'm only telling you what the Upanishads say. By being able to go deeper and deeper, and whatever that essence you are, it's not this ego or the self. When I say I, what is this I? The Upanishads have a big discussion on what this I is. In fact, as I mentioned to you, Gavin, I've written too on the identity of the self. So this identity of the self, what is this self, you see? So that self is not this little self. And unless you know, that is supposed to be peeled off like an onion, you know. You peel off the skin and skin and skin, and I believe if you can get to that state, which would be the essence. So that's all I can tell you.
And most of us will probably find nothing.
Nothing. That's why I said nothing there or all things.
Ramana Maharshi realized.
Ah, yes.
I mean, it's a.
You have to believe these. Yes. These. No, Ramana Maharshi also. How many of us can really, you know, he just walked away at the age of 13 or 14 and never wanted to, you know, that state of mind. I don't, maybe it comes for those very few. That's why I said, though moksha is mentioned as the highest value, there are very few people who can realize it. But does it mean that we discard it because very few people? No, that's the highest value. Because Jivan Mukti, the Upanishads are the only texts in the entire, I would think, spiritual literature of the world which talk about Jivan Mukti, you know, moksha while living in the world itself. Most of others are post-mortem. You know, you die and then you achieve whatever you get. But to be able to really, see, so in a certain sense, it's extremely fascinating to be told that you can achieve it here and now. And Jnanat Mukti, so that's all I can tell you. Read the Upanishads.
Shukra, Vyasa did not.
Well, some individuals do give us that instinctive sense that they have achieved Jivan Mukti.
But they will never be able to explain it or even tell you what it is.
Nobody can tell you. You realize it and you, I guess.
If they say so, one would be very suspicious.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Can I return?
Please.
Sorry,
yes.
Please go ahead.
No, I think after you.
Okay. It has been very illuminating, your talk and everything, very informative. But I come from a completely different area of work. Not scholarly question. That's very vast. What I was trying to ask you, is it possible, you know, in Buddhism also they talk about moksha.
Nirvana.
Nirvana, moksha. Can you draw an analogy between them? And, of course, a little bit what I know about it is Buddhism, Sikhism, it's an aftermath of Hinduism, isn't it? And also when they talked about this division caste system, you know, that's the question we are often faced with, isn't it? Why there's a privilege for Brahmana and why Shudra is discriminated. And it really creeped in with the social evils of Hinduism. That's the question we are often faced with. And so is there much difference between the two when you call Nirvana is it how it is described also in our Bhagavad Gita, I think, when the caste system was described? is there any privilege drawn to between those two?
In the Bhagavad Gita, there's no distinction.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone, even
everyone,
the Brahmana,
the same.
Whatever. But still, they have discussion on Varnashrama and all, okay? Swadharma is important there. But you see, like, I always try to understand this in a social context, as you very rightly put it. Because what are we doing? We are professors or teachers, students. Isn't there a class system in every society? Right? So in that sense, so I'm not going to get into the caste system discussion at all, because that will take us to a different plane. But I'll come to the nirvana and moksha. You see, in Buddhism, I don't know, Gavin, you've done some work in Buddhism, haven't you?
I used to have to teach Buddhism.
Yes, so probably you can correct me if I'm wrong. My knowledge of Buddhism, not from the Pali texts, but it's only the later Sanskrit texts, Mula Madhyama Karika and things like that. So, the basic difference, as you know, Buddhism does not believe in a permanent entity like Atman. They're called Anatmavada. Okay? So, if you go to the text, you'll find a lot of the discussion going on. How can you achieve nirvana if there's nobody to achieve nirvana? Because if there is a momentary, as they call pratitya samutpada, that means there is a momentariness. The individual is, every moment there is a new person coming into existence. I'm not going to go into the skandhas and all that, but let's just understand it plainly, saying that there's a new person coming into existence all the time. Mind also new. Everything is momentary, okay? So, if you are attaining nirvana, the person who started the practice of prajna, they have this meditation, is very important. They're extremely spiritual, though they don't believe in Atman, they don't believe in Deva or anything, yet Buddhism is one extremely spiritual. And so, the criticism is that if there is no permanent somebody who is to achieve nirvana, who is it that achieves nirvana? Okay, but that is not a valid criticism, because they have their own way of looking at the Atman, or the Anatma Atman, I should say, the self. How would you call it? Just that entity.
Pudgala.
It is a series.
The Pudgala.
Pudgala, very good. You can call it the Pudgala, yes. It's a dharma or dharma. You see, what happens is every moment another one is coming into existence. Like if this momentarily one goes out of existence, the next moment this one leaves its sanskara into the next one. So in a certain sense, the last one is in a sense similar but not identical. You see, now there is a difference between similarity and identity. So in that sense, they believe in coming back, going. They believe in the karma theory, you know, that chakra, the dharma chakra. And Trishna is very important for them. Once you get rid of Trishna, then of course the chain will be broken. And then of course, once the chain is broken, you will attain nirvana. But, they do believe in nirvana. Mm-hmm. The difference is only this, as I said.
Thank you.
You want to add something?
Oh, I did, but no, we have got time really for what I was going to say, so I'll take it up with you another time.
Okay. I don't mind if you don't.
Oh, well, the question was, I'll tell you the question, but it was playing devil's advocate. Going back to the beginning of your talk, you said that Western philosophy has a discourse about ethics, and that Hinduism, so it is, has been claimed, hasn't. Now, you could argue that actually what you've shown is that there's an ethical discourse, but nevertheless there's not a discourse about ethics, in the sense that you read Charles Taylor's book, Sources of the Self.
Yes, yes.
And
I like that book.
It's all about your fellow Canadian, and
yes,
it's all about the moral sources for self-identity in the modern world. And you look at Hindu discourses about the self, and that's not the question that they go to immediately. There's questions of ontology and epistemology, but not ethics in that sense. So,
no, that's exactly my... I started off by saying that. Why do you want to draw exact parallels?
All right, yes.
You see, I mean, that's my answer to that question,
yes.
Because this is the problem we have. Because we look for exact parallels. Why should we?
Why should we?
I mean, culturally even, we need not have exact parallels, but you can be a good man, I can be a good woman, though I may dress differently, I may talk differently. So you see, in that sense, looking for exact parallels is what is problematic here.
So you're not claiming that there is a discourse about ethics in Hinduism?
I'm not claiming there's a discourse on ethics in the same manner in which you have theoretical discussions on moral philosophy in the West. But at the same time, it is not deficient in moral philosophy. That's what I'm claiming. Right. People have not written. Because you see, what happened, Gavin, in India, you have Dharma Sutras. See, there was a kind of a classification. You take care of this, we take care of this. The Dharma Sutras came in, and they have these huge texts, Apastamba, Bodhayana, all these people. They are laying down rules. So, it's how you start. Like, you know, when if women start by saying, we have, if I sit and say, I have all the freedom in the world, and then I go and look at an African village and say, okay, you don't have any freedom. It's where I start from. But then I have to qualify that, you see, by saying, what kind of milieu are you addressing? What kind of culture you are addressing? I have a feeling it's, one need not really look for exact parallels. It's concept-wise. Do we have the same concept? Do you have the same kind of approach to life? You know, those things. Truth, for instance, can be defined so differently. The concept truth is there in all cultures, and yet, you know, yes. So that's what I definitely, that would be my answer to
you. Thank you. Well, thanks very much. That was really very interesting. Thank you so much for sharing your ideas with us. Well, that's it. And then next week we have two more Shiv Dasani seminars.